Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our program. We're very happy that we're able to move on with our Asian Pacific Strategic Challenges series. And today we're delighted to have our Asia Society Chairman, Richard Holbrooke, who will be our featured speaker today. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank Tony Korsman and CSIS for being our partner in today's event. And with that, I'd like to invite Tony up to introduce Ambassador Holbrooke.
There is really only one way to introduce somebody who everybody knows and respects, and that is to do it just as quickly as humanly possible. I'd like to thank the Asian Foundation for working with us on this. This is the first time in history that Ambassador Holbrooke has ever interrupted anyone. Seriously, ladies and gentlemen, it is a privilege to introduce Richard Holbrooke. I'm not going to give you any more details. I think you all know them. The subject he's talking about is one that is, I think, of vast interest to all of us and critical to our security. And Ambassador Holbrooke, with that, let me introduce you.
I'm sorry, Tony, I had to do that because we're always getting confused with the Asia Foundation. And an understandable thing, but I'm just delighted to be here and to talk about this region of the world. And I thank so many of you for coming out, and I thank CSIS for hosting a joint CSIS Asia Society effort. We are building up as much as we can here in Washington. Asia Society is on a very aggressive expansionary effort. We have a new U.S.-China Center headed by Orville Schell in Washington. We just opened centers in Mumbai and Seoul. And I'd like to open one in Islamabad if we can work it out. And we propose to make ourselves one of the centers of dialogue on the subject that we're here primarily to talk about today. Let me plunge right in so we can get to the questions and just say that it's no secret to those of you in this room that the situation in Afghanistan is critically important to the United States, just as important as Iraq. But I don't think it's widely understood exactly what the nature of it is or its connection to the situation in Pakistan. So let me propose to you that there is a theater of operations, which I will call, for purposes of this discussion, AFPAC, Afghanistan-Pakistan. In the western half of AFPAC, NATO forces operate, and that is the part that gets the attention. In the eastern part, across the border, the federally administered tribal areas, Fatah, and other areas along that long and complicated border, NATO forces are not able to function, except for the occasional predator that accidentally strays across the border and accidentally kills some Taliban, we hope, and not some innocent people. But quite seriously, this is an extraordinary theater of operations because the NATO forces can only fight on one side of it, and success is not possible unless there's success on both sides of it. This administration has utterly failed to conceive of it as a single strategic theater. It is part of a massive policy breakdown in this area, which I think is going to require urgent repair by whoever the next president of the United States is. I see no likelihood that this administration has either the time or the understanding of the area to fix it. Even if they did understand it, and they certainly have gotten better recently, there's no time left, and there's no time to forge a consensus. Now, what is the nature of the problem? Let me start with Afghanistan. I would submit to you that the war in Afghanistan, now in its seventh year, will, before it's over, be the longest war in American history. The longest war currently is, of course, Vietnam, measured at its maximum, 1961 to 1975, 14 years. I see no likelihood that we can achieve our objectives in a time frame that would mean that we would be out of Afghanistan in that period of time. That's a daunting statement with massive political implications, and I don't say it with any great joy. But the alternative would be a strategic setback to the United States and the return of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to Afghanistan. And I think that's an unacceptable outcome to the United States. Why do I think it's going to be the longest war in American history? Well, as I see it, based on two trips there in the last 2 years and spending as much time as I can with people who know something about it, as I see it, the Taliban simply can't win. I do not believe it's correct to say we're losing in Afghanistan, but it is absolutely correct to say we're not winning. And in the long run, in this sort of war, if the guerrillas don't lose, they end up winning. In the long run, I stress that. I see in the room some veterans and colleagues of mine from another war in another part of Asia, somewhat to the east from a distant century, like my old boss, Bob Miller. And we lived through situations which were not dissimilar in Vietnam back in the 60s and 70s. The Taliban cannot win because their strategy is based on suicide bombers and terrorism, and they have no real positive elements except this deeply fundamentalist attitude towards social issues. They're not really interested in governance, and they have, above all, left a legacy and memories of what it was like when they were in power, which makes them intensely unpopular among almost all Afghans. Certainly all non-Pashtun Afghans hate them. Almost all women hate them, for obvious reasons, and a good chunk of the men do. So they cannot win a popular insurrection or insurgency. However, the Karzai government cannot win either. It is weak, it is corrupt, it has a very thin leadership veneer, it is internally divided, it has never arrested any major drug lords. When I put that proposition to President Karzai last month, he laughed and said he'd arrested some sub-drug lords, which he seemed to think was amusing. But when you have American and NATO troops fighting and risking their lives and dying, it's unacceptable to have this kind of situation. The weakness of the government is so much greater than is understood here that it undermines the possibility of building a successful government effort. That leaves us, and I mean NATO, but by NATO I mean the U.S., well over half of the forces, and that percentage is going to increase. That leaves us as the balance that will keep the Taliban at bay, but cannot win the war. Only the government can do this. Now, let me give you a specific example, both from the province of Khust, which I visited last month down on the Pakistan border, and from the current new deployments of the United States Marines in Helmand. I was with the 101st Airborne in Khust for a couple of days, and with the Provincial Reconstruction Team, the PRT, and with the civilians from the embassy, who included some absolutely superb young diplomats of the very sort that you will remember from Vietnam, Bob. And they were doing their job, and their job was to clean out the province of Khust of the Taliban. And they were quite successful. Khust has moved from a red province on the maps in Kabul to a contested province, elements of which are still red, but elements of which have moved to yellow or green or whatever color code they want to use. All of this in less than a year. And all of this, and by the way, this is a province right on the border, and it's a province that Osama bin Laden spent some time in as he planned 9/11 and moved around Afghanistan And so it was a very dangerous area at one time. And now it's reasonably safe. I stress the word reasonably because you cannot take it for granted. The colonel commanding there, Colonel Custer, I kid you not, Colonel Custer, it gets better. He's a direct descendant of General Custer. Colonel Custer, the young Foreign Service officer, Cale Weston, these guys are just doing a splendid job. They're working with a terrific provincial governor who used to be the head of CARE in the United Kingdom. And that combination has really made a difference. Schools are opening, roads are being built, the people seem much happier. But there are several problems. I met with the university students, I met with some mullahs, some madrasa students, some Taliban defectors, and some tribal elders, all in separate groups. And they all were thrilled the Americans were there. But less than two weeks before I'd gotten there, special forces or Delta teams out of a completely separate command, commanded directly from the command in Tampa, Florida, had dropped in on a village in the middle of the night and had kicked the doors in and shot up some people who they thought were high-level al-Qaeda. Women and children were killed. And the tribal elders, who really want the Americans to stay, said, "You understand this is completely unacceptable." One of them said to me, "I can't even enter my brother's house in the middle of the night, and these guys kicked the doors in." The Americans on the ground were mortified by this. They did not know this operation was going to take place. They hadn't been notified because of operational security needs. The command in Kabul said it was a legitimate target. The province governor, who's tremendously pro-American, said, "This undermines me." This incident, which you may have read about in the papers because it got international attention, was one of only several of that sort that have taken place and were part of the reason Karzai criticized the U.S. recently publicly. He really had no choice in this case. Beyond the specifics of that kind of problem lies a much deeper problem, and this is the one I want to really focus your attention on. It's our long-term dilemma. If we succeed in Khost Province, or even more dramatically, if the Marines, who are now being dropped into the most dangerous part of the country, right in the heart of Helmand, where the British have had such a difficult time, and they're going to be deployed in 30 or 40 small little units around Helmand. Once these troops come in, 101st Airborne or the Marines, there is no doubt they will clear out the space they arrive at. And they won't have much difficulty doing it. But it's like putting your fist in the water. You withdraw your fist, the water reforms around you. Unless you can leave something permanent behind as you withdraw your fist. The theory, of course, is, we all understand this, that we will stay a certain amount of time to be defined, and then we will build up the Afghan security forces, and they will gradually replace us. That's the same theory that General Petraeus has in Iraq. And there's much more likelihood in theory that it could work in Afghanistan because there's far more unity in the country than there is in Iraq, and the unanimity of opposition to the Taliban works in favor of that strategy. However, the incompetence of the government, the tremendous corruption of the national police, the inadequacies of the army, although it's improving, and quite frankly, the lack of a guiding, strong strategic hand by the United States for our part of the effort, all combine to make me highly dubious that such a handoff is foreseeable at any time in the future, near term or midterm. In fact, I am concerned that the reverse will happen, that the theory is we create a security space and the local authorities replace us in it and we gradually withdraw. That's the theory. What actually happens, in my view, is that the local authorities become more dependent on the Americans. Why? Simple. Better logistics, better intelligence, better communications, close air support. We're honest. We have this thing called CERP, Commander's Emergency Relief Program, where commanders can walk around the country giving unvouchered funds to anybody for almost anything up to a certain level, and that level in Afghan terms is quite substantial. I think it's $10,000 or $20,000 last time I checked. And so people become more dependent on the Americans because the government system is such a mess. So that is our dilemma. We can't leave. The other side can't win. And the government is not performing up to scratch. One word about the drug program. I mentioned earlier that no drug lords have been arrested ever, ever. This is an absolute scandal. But it's compounded by an appalling American-backed program. In fact, the worst one I have ever seen in the very substantial amount of time, 40-plus years since I first entered the U.S. government and went off to Vietnam. I've seen a lot of wasteful programs in my time. But this is by far the worst American foreign assistance program I've ever seen. Because it isn't just wasted money. It's actually recruiting the enemy. The idea, we're spending $700-800 million a year on drug eradication, as a result of which the drug crop keeps increasing. I work on Wall Street now, and that's not a good business model. And 40% increase in the crop. Worse than that, because we're only going after the poorest farmers who are growing it because it's the best cash crop, we are driving them into the hands of the Taliban. So the drug money's, it's a kind of a perfect trifecta. The money is going to the Taliban, the drug lords, and corrupt police officials. It's recruiting Taliban, and it has no effect on the worldwide heroin trade. And 50% of the GDP of the country, according to UN and US estimates, is now in the drug trade, and it is becoming a narco state. And nothing upsets me more than to see this waste of money. The American ambassador in Kabul, Bill Wood, is an open advocate of aerial spraying. And so is President Bush, who famously told meetings that he's a spray man himself. And that's a quote. And it's not a partisan remark. He's proud he's a spray man. But I'm not going to discuss spraying in Central Texas, but spraying in Afghanistan is a terrible idea. The ambassador says that if we can't spray, he'd like NATO troops to accompany the drug sprayers. He doesn't want the Americans to actually spray, but just to give them security. This doesn't work either. If you read John Lee Anderson's brilliant piece on the drug trade last year in The New Yorker, he ends it with a vivid description of going on one of these eradication missions, and they walk down a road, and there are poppy seeds on both sides of the road, and they spray and they destroy all the poppies on the left side of the road, and they don't touch the ones on the right side. And the American advisor, Doug Wankel, who I'm sure you knew, Doug Wankel was with us in Indochina 30 years ago, very senior guy in the DEA business. Wankel says, let's do the poppies on the right side of the road. Oh, no, say the police. Then we'd get into a fight. Of course, what happened was that the Americans were backing with taxpayer dollars a drug eradication program, which was actually simply supporting one tribal leader over another in a local dispute over market share. It's not a tenable position. Now, everyone always says, okay, it's a mess. What would you do about it? I don't really know exactly what to do about it. I haven't spent enough time there. I don't know enough about it. But I have a feeling, and I've suggested this before, that rather than try to eradicate poppies and opium traffic right off the bat, which cannot be done, which is incredibly expensive, we should approach the agricultural sector in Afghanistan as an organic whole. 70% of the people are agricultural. It's an agricultural society. It's landlocked. It's never going to have a major export economy, although it could again be a food exporting area as it was in the 1960s and 70s before tragedy hit that country. And my model would be something like the New Deal's agricultural programs, where you do an soup to nuts, A to Z approach to agricultural sector. Seeds, fertilizer, water, markets, roads, farmer education. And you get them to take other crops. If they have roads, if there are markets, it is doable. But just to destroy crops and talk about an alternative livelihood program, which last year the Congress appropriated $227 million for, but you can't find anyone in the country who ever got a different job as a result of that $227 million, is not, to my mind, the way to go. One last word in Pakistan, and then, Tony, I'll turn it back over to you. Two things in Pakistan, the domestic situation in Islamabad and the situation on the border. I am a very strong supporter of what we've just seen in Pakistan. I think the Bush administration was correct in 2001, 2002 to put its money in Musharraf. He rallied to us right after 9/11. He made a great speech in January of 2002 promising three things: democracy, closing down the madrasas, and dealing with the terrorists on the border. He delivered on none of these three. And by the time we reached the end of last year, Pakistan was widely regarded in journalism cliches in this town and elsewhere as the most dangerous country in the world. Well, it really isn't, although it does contain on its border an area of immense danger to our homeland security. But it's not a danger to itself. It has a democratic system of its own sort, heavily based on feudal landlords and so on. But when they finally had an election, only 4% of the people voted for any of the Islamic parties. The two big parties, Benazir Bhutto's party and Sharif's party, banded together in a kind of a grand coalition. Musharraf is still president, but he's now reduced more or less to a ceremonial chief of state with some residual powers, which are being negotiated downward as we speak in Islamabad. And I was there when this explosion of democracy took place, and I'm very enthusiastic about it. I think it gives far greater participation. I don't know whether this grand coalition can work. Zardari and Sharif could not be more different, and they don't like each other. But still, it's a lot better than where we were. And Musharraf himself, whom I also saw, is trying to salvage something out of his position. But the administration should not get involved in anything which makes it appear that they're nostalgic for General Musharraf. And regrettably, that is the impression many people in Pakistan have. So that's the good news. The problem, of course, is in the West, on the border areas. I spent a couple of days and 3 days in Peshawar and in the tribal areas up on the Khyber Pass. But if I were to tell you that I understood what was going on there, I would be misleading you. I don't know what's going on. I don't believe anyone on the outside knows what's going on. It is a very obscure and difficult area with an ancient tradition. But the one thing I am certain of is that the United States government has no policy or strategy for that area. The GAO report that came out last month says that flatly. I read the GAO report carefully, and I agree with almost everything in it. I just came from the Hill, where Tom Pickering and Jim Jones and I were testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. They said the same thing. They issued a very bleak report on Afghanistan and Pakistan. But the U.S., the administration, the State Department, now does have a plan for Fatah, and I was briefed on it, and it's not classified. They want $750 million over the next 5 years for reconstruction in the tribal areas. $750 million sounds like a lot. But over 5 years, that's $150 million a year. And if you look at the way the U.S. government now works, and this is part of another problem we have, which is global, that money, a good chunk of that money, will be given to consultants, NGOs, and organizations in the United States, many of them only after they've passed political litmus tests. They, in turn, will subcontract it to NGOs and organizations in Pakistan. And the result is that nobody in Washington, not the U.S. State Department, not the embassy in Islamabad, not the Congress who appropriates the money, none of you in this room, unless some enterprising journalist goes out into the tribal areas and actually tracks it down, will have the faintest idea what the money is being spent for. So the line item will say school building. And no one in Washington or Islamabad will know what kind of schools are they being built or anything like that. And a very substantial amount of the money will never leave the hands of Americans. Now, the estimate on how much that is ranges from 30% to 70%. So I really don't know what it is. I'm not talking about the famous cases like Blackwater or DynCorp. I'm talking about organizations that do this stuff for a living and now have an extraordinary disproportionate role in the implementation of foreign policy with no end-user checks. So I would simply say that the $750 million program the State Department is promoting is pathetically small, $150 million a year, compared to the staggering amounts of money that we are spending in Afghanistan. Last year, $10.5 billion in reconstruction funds, although, as Tony pointed out, over $7 billion of that is for security, and he's quite right. This year, the request is about $5.5 billion. Whatever the numbers, if we're serious about Afghanistan, we've got to be equally serious about the Fatah areas. So thank you very much for inviting me here, and thank you all for coming. I will be very happy to respond to questions, or even better, just hear from any of you, your own views. There are a lot of experts in the room, and there's one person in particular I want to introduce to you in the question and answer period. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. I think I have a very limited range of functions here. One of them is just to briefly note, next week we will be putting out a survey of what has happened in the Afghan war. A lot of the maps, a lot of the charts simply reinforce the points the ambassador has made. But my main function is to ensure that the ambassador can get to an airplane on time, which means that the meeting has to end fairly promptly at 1:45, I believe.
I think
two o'clock, all right. We just extended it by 15 minutes, but if you look around the room, you'll see there are quite a number of people. If I may ask you to try to keep remarks reasonably brief, to wait for the microphone after I recognize you, and to identify yourself when the microphone arrives, I'd be very grateful. And with that, let me open things up for questions. The gentleman there in the front row.
Thank you, sir.
That was great.
Raghubir Goyal from India Globe and Asia Today. Mr. Ambassador, great presentation. And very educational. My quick question is that you said that U.S. is not winning or losing this war. One, what, and also you said that there is no time left for the administration. The question is that whatever time has left for this administration, Bush administration, what suggestion do you have or advice for him or for the coming administration? And finally, sir, what do we expect or the U.S. can expect from the new government in Pakistan? And do you believe there is Osama bin Laden, or do you expect that we will have Osama bin Laden one day?
On Osama bin Laden, Anthony Cordesman is going to give you the real answer on that. So I'm just going to let him tell you the answer to that. Giving advice to this administration is not something I've been very good at. They I just am so disappointed in what they've done in Afghanistan that I really can hardly express it, because I really care about this country on its own merits and above all because it's vital to our national security interests. And because time is over and the appropriations authorization process restructuring, it takes a while. Having said that, I believe the next administration is going to have some tremendously important decisions to make. All three presidential candidates have said Afghanistan will be a very high priority. None of them have gone into excessive detail. It's obvious that if you do start a drawdown from Iraq, you have more forces available. I do not think, and I should have said this earlier, I do not think a massive troop increase is the answer to Afghanistan. As I said, Taliban is not going to win. And the only way our side, and we all understand how that's defined, can win, is if the government does a better job. And so governance, in its broadest sense, dealing with corruption, dealing with the drug culture, these are the things that must be done. The police must be cleaned up. Now, this will take time. The American public seems to accept this in a very oversimplified way. At this point in time, Afghanistan is the good war because it's of its origins in 9/11 and because of a tremendous affection for the country. When we have events at Asia Society like this one with CSIS today, when we showed the kite runner in previews, and there's standing room only, people, the literature in Afghanistan, people know there's something extraordinary and compelling about that country. And its origins in 9/11, and Iraq, of course, is the bad war in the eyes of two-thirds of the American public. So there's time to get a national consensus on this issue. It's not a politically partisan issue. And nothing I've said today should be viewed, I hope, as partisanship, but rather strategic and tactical suggestions to succeed in an objective which we all share. I guess that sort of covers most of your questions, except Osama bin Laden. And I'm not. Oh yes, the new government in Pakistan in regard to what? The Fatah? Look, the biggest concern people have in Kabul, and I think here in Washington, is that the new negotiations going on between the Pakistani government and some of the really worst people in Fatah will result in a deal that if these bad guys, whoever they are, Taliban, warlords, militia, criminals, if they will leave the Pakistani populated areas alone, they can have a free hand in Afghanistan. That's a very bad deal for us. And so we have to find a policy where we support democracy but deal with Fatah, the Fatah region, on a integrated basis. And that's a very complicated issue. I would build up the Frontier Corps, although some people think the Frontier Corps is a charade. I visited it, and I think you could work with it, and it's existed since the 19th century. I'd go into a road-building program, and I would work very hard with the Pakistani military to reorient its troops, which, as everyone here knows, they were all designed to fight India or to fight in Kashmir. And now they have to start reorienting towards another area of the world, of their own country. Do you want to answer the Osama question, Tony?
I have his exact GPS coordinates, but regrettably they refused to give me the $25 million in advance. In the third row there, please. Gentlemen in the third row.
Thank you, Ambassador. Dimitri Sevastopoulos, Financial Times. Could I just get you to expand a little bit on the peace deals and the negotiations between the Pakistani government and some of these militias? The Pentagon is trying to do more training in that area. You have a new general, General Kiani, that the Pentagon supports, and yet the administration is deciding how they should respond to this. Do you think they should support the peace deals, which the intelligence community said last time around created a vacuum, or how do they deal with it?
The 2006 deal of President Musharraf is now universally regarded as a failure, including by President Musharraf himself. But before we just move on, we have to note that at the time, the United States government said it was a good deal. And I say that because it underscores my core belief that the U.S. government doesn't really understand this region very well. The current negotiations are being conducted without Americans really knowing exactly what's going on, and a tremendous amount of conflicting information about whether Bitola Mesood was behind Benazir Bhutto's murder or not. I mean, her husband says no. The U.S. government says yes. That's not the kind of public. That's not the kind of disagreement you want to see in public. But we're getting it. I really don't know how to answer your question. I don't understand the area. As I said earlier, I don't understand the tribal areas. I don't think Americans do understand them very well. But for those of you who haven't studied the tribal areas, there are a couple of important factoids to bear in mind. It's administered under a law written in 1901 under the British Raj in India. And that law is now they're now talking about either scrapping it or amending it. Political parties are not allowed in the tribal areas. And so the picture of the tribal areas you get just hearing about them is you think of some wild, jungly area. But, you know, a lot of it is like the road up the Khyber Pass. That's just a dusty truck route. And it's not an uncivilized area. It has a unique history with strong tribal roots. And the issue of how to work with the tribal leaders is an enormously difficult one. There are people in this room who have had that experience. But I don't know the answer to your question. I'm sorry. I wish I did, but it's way beyond my level of knowledge at this point. I do feel very strongly that the current U.S. government policies towards that problem are not even policies at all. They're just a lot of postures based on limited information.
The gentleman over there.
If I understand you correctly...
Could you identify yourself, please?
Raj Surin, I am independent, don't represent anybody. If I understand you correctly, you're saying the main part of the problem is corruption. I don't see how the United States government or anybody else can go and change that, whether you change from poppies to wheat or anybody else. The landlords are still going to be there. The left side is still going to fight the right side. How do you manage corruption? Anything else, you can put up $1 million or $20 billion is not going to change that, because that is the culture of that place.
Province chiefs and police chiefs who are deeply on the take. Every policeman. The UN vehicle that we were driving around in dropped us off at the Serena Hotel, and the woman who was taking us around came back a couple of hours later very shaken. She's an Afghan-American from Sacramento, and said that the police had stopped on a main intersection in Kabul and tried to steal the car. This is not acceptable. And the amount of money we are spending to train the police and the military is off the charts. As for the drug culture, you walk around the marketplace in Kabul, and you see a big villa, and you ask somebody who that villa belongs to, and they'll say, well, that's General so-and-so. He's the drug lord of such and such a province. Everybody knows who it is. Why hasn't President Karzai arrested these people? He has his own explanation, which I just don't buy. They're too strong. Well, they're getting stronger and stronger. The U.S. government has to answer for having put some of these people back into power after 2001, 2002. And I want to be clear with you, I don't believe you can have a strong unitary government run from Kabul in Afghanistan. That defies the culture of Afghanistan. It's going to be a loosely governed country. But unlike Iraq, it does not have secessionist and separatist tendencies. Afghans, whether they're Dari or Pashtun or Hazari or any of the others, they all feel they're part of Afghanistan. And they need a better government or else we're not going to succeed. I'm not trying to drop everything out. Tony, with your permission, I want to introduce somebody I brought with me today, Saad Mohseini, who is the CEO of Tolo TV, also known as Mobi TV. Saad is a brilliant and courageous young Afghan who was raised in Melbourne and who, along with his brothers, came back to Kabul to set up free and independent media in the aftermath of our getting the Taliban out. He has on television the single most popular program in Afghanistan, Afghan Star, modeled not loosely but exactly after American Idol. And he took me to the finals of it up on the hill at the Intercontinental Hotel. It was, to me, it kind of symbolized your whole incredible country. Inside the hotel were hundreds of young Afghans, male and female, waving electric wands and cheering for the person they wanted to win. And all the losing contestants came out. And the person who'd come in number three, was a girl from Kandahar. And that is even more revolutionary than Paula Abdul when she's not drunk. I mean, really seriously amazing. And it was very exciting. It was the modernizing part of Afghanistan. At the bottom of the hill, blocking the access to the hotel, so we had to try another route, were hundreds of Afghans, many of them the same age as the kids up there, in more traditional clothing, demonstrating very aggressively against Westernization. They weren't demonstrating against the show. They were demonstrating against the Danish cartoons, which is a perennial. When the mullahs don't know what else to do, let's get angry at the Danes again. But the contrast of the two Afghanistans was very, very clear. And Tony, I'd like to ask Saad to say a little bit about what's happening with the free media, because as some of you may have seen in the New York Times last week, they're going after the Indian soap operas very aggressively now. And this is not just about Indian soap operas. It's about the whole Karzai government's move back towards giving a lot more power to conservatives whose social programs are very similar to that of the Taliban. And I thought you all might like to meet Saad. He's just in the States for a few days. Saad, can we give Saad a microphone and let him say a few words?
Thank you, Richard. We're actually very pleased that we have friends like Richard. Afghanistan is actually quite a unique country that people, once they're exposed to Afghanistan and Afghans, it's like a virus or a bug. I'm not sure it's a good thing, but people tend to somehow stay with Afghanistan, and Ambassador Holbrooke is one of those people, so thank you. The Afghan Star final was very interesting because Ambassador Holbrooke had problems containing himself. A couple of times he almost got up to dance, but we told him it's not the appropriate thing to do. It's comforting to hear that the Taliban will not win the war in Afghanistan, but the danger is that they are winning another war, the cultural and social war in Afghanistan. We have had incidents over the last 6 or so months where various restrictions have been imposed on the medium, such as the Indian soap operas, legislation being drafted in the Afghan parliament to ban men and women interacting, makeup in public places, loud music at weddings, designer jeans for young men, and various other things. And the concern is that the Taliban are returning by stealth, right under the noses of our Western friends, and essentially endorsed by a government which is supposedly a pro-Western government. On the ground, obviously, we refer to it nowadays as the re-Talibanization of Afghanistan. And ironically, it's not a grassroots movement. It's a movement led by radical individuals who work from within Kabul or from within the system. And this is something that we believe is against the will and the demands of the public, but is something that we're experiencing on a day-to-day basis. For example, the Ulama Council, which is a council made up of Islamic scholars nominated by the government, paid by the government, instructed us to stop airing various soap operas, Indian soap operas. Now, there is a due process. If the shows in any way break Afghanistan's laws, there is a process through which the government can actually prosecute. But without any any care for that, we were instructed to cut the show. And this has the support of the minister, has the support of the president, and the majority of members of the cabinet. And also the parliament of Afghanistan, led by some of the more radical MPs, who ironically are also very pro-government MPs, have drafted another set of laws in relation to dancing on stage or dancing on television, music, women appearing on television, and of course I just mentioned the social behavior laws, which are currently in draft format, awaiting discussion or debate in parliament. So these are some issues that concern us greatly, and it should concern you. This is a government that's heavily subsidized by the international community. We believe that conditions need to be imposed on the assistance that's rendered to the Afghan government. And certainly from where we stand, the signs are very, very dangerous. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm still trying to get over the mental image of Ambassador Holbrooke as Paul Abdul, but I will move forward regardless. The gentleman in the first row.
Secretary Holbrooke, my question is about Pakistani Army's reorientation. Do you really believe that a Pakistani Army is willing to do that, given that in the psyche of deep down, Pakistani Army is India and Kashmir? And Musharraf, what he did, his whole idea was to stay in power. He really didn't safeguard Pakistani interest. If he was sincere, he would try to resolve that issue for which Pakistani Army is born or prepared. So, I mean, he kind of made fool of Bush by just getting his support to stay in power. So unless we
address
this Kashmir
issue
properly,
please.
Do you really believe that there would be a peace in that part of the world? Thanks.
Do I really believe there'll be peace in that part of the world over Kashmir?
Without solving that issue.
Well, I'm not quite clear where you're taking a question. If your thesis is that Kashmir must be fixed before the Pakistani government can deal with the tribal areas, then I must respectfully disagree with you, because Kashmir is now entering its 61st year of unresolved conflict, and things are getting calmer. There's even some tourism now on the Great Lakes, and there are far less troops on both sides of the border, and there has been a semi-secret, semi-public dialogue, which has done pretty well, and there have been a tremendous reduction in troops on both sides, and a lot of those troops have gone to the West. The problem is, in my understanding, and this is all secondhand, and again, Tony may have additional information. My understanding is that even when you shift the troops, they're completely trained for the Indian contingency, and therefore they have to be retrained I read in the papers that we're going to train them in counterinsurgency. Well, that doesn't fill me with optimism. Our record on that field isn't so good either. Right, Rufus? My first boss in the world I spied in the room earlier, Rufus Phillips, who I went to work with in Saigon in 1963. And so I have a lot of former bosses in the room. And our strategy that General Petraeus, that manual he wrote, any one of us who served in Vietnam read that manual 40 years ago. That really is the old. That's just rediscovering the wheel, and doesn't seem to show any lessons learned from Vietnam. And therefore, I'm worried about that. But I don't accept your core thesis based on what I've heard. However, the issue you've raised is centrally important to the future of American national security, and we have to see how this new government, this grand coalition, works. Several people mentioned General Kiani. General Kiani is a critical factor in this equation. He has said he wants to get the military out of politics. If he means that and sticks to it, it would be a fantastic event. As we all know, Pakistan has these cycles, usually about 10 years on and off, between military intervention and civilian rule. and a very bad track record. General Kiani is absolutely indispensable to that. And when I asked to see him, he refused to see me. And I was very pleased at this. The people setting up my schedule were a little bit embarrassed. I said, no, it's great. He doesn't want to see. He also wouldn't see Senator Biden and Senator Hagel and Senator Kerry. He said, but he did see the chairman of the JCS twice in a one-month period. I thought that was terrific. I keeping out of the political sphere is just the right way to go.
The lady in the back row. Please wait for the microphone and identify yourself. Let me also note, given the time, if
sure, it's very
one
brief.
Question per person at this point.
If you would indulge the wife of a war veteran, a two-part question. Following on your strategic and tactical comments, I am curious if I am the only person in the United States who read an article in The Atlantic a few years ago that said the most effective way... It's a simple question. The most effective way to fight terrorism is to drop a platoon into hot spots, and they profiled one in the Philippines. You build roads, schools, and clinics. Win the hearts and minds. Is that a viable tactical option for the United States?
I think I just answered that. That is exactly what the Marines are going to do in Helmand, and it will work. Just as it worked in every other insurgency that I've seen in the last 40 years, until you get to the point when you say, okay, we're going to leave, you take over. I think I addressed that in some detail already. It's the handoff part of that strategy which is not addressed neither in Iraq nor in Afghanistan, and it has a much better chance of success in Afghanistan because the people are with the Americans. But they're not so sure about that government.
The gentleman in the second row there.
That's my first boss in the world, Rufus Phillips, who ran the Rural Affairs Office in Saigon and sent me down to the lower Mekong Delta in 1963. I was 21 years old, and I had no business being there, Rufus.
But and you did a good job.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, you see, job. In regard to your point, we were doing exactly that. We had a lot of commodities. We were handing them out. Vietnamese loved them. Didn't make any difference because the province chief, Colonel Thieu, was a corrupt guy. And the whole thing fell on that core.
It's precisely that area that I want to ask a question about. And that is that I infer from your remarks that we're really not looking at the process of trying to get the central government both functioning and reaching down while we're trying to build something from the ground up.
Right.
And connect these two things so eventually we can leave.
Right.
But we don't have that vision at the top. Is
right.
that correct?
Saddle up, Rufus. You're going back. That's that. You know, I don't mean to sound like we're antiques from another century, but there is value to experience. And Rufus has summed up exactly. He's just written a book, which I'm honored to write the foreword for. He summed up exactly why we didn't succeed in Vietnam. Plus, let me remind you, there was a sanctuary issue there too. I want to be clear because I'm stressing the problems. I really support this effort in Afghanistan. It's vital to us. I care about the people, the country, and our national interests. But the way we're doing it now, it's going to stretch on endlessly. CNN had a program on last month with Nick Robertson, Afghanistan, War Without End. I think that kind of captured it.
The gentleman in the first row there.
Yes, Glenn Kessler with the Washington Post. If President Karzai decides to run for a third term, should the U.S. encourage that, or should it be trying to seek a new generation of leadership in Afghanistan?
Next question. Glenn, I knew we shouldn't have invited you. I think the question you've asked is going to be one of the half dozen most important tactical decisions the next president will make. This election is in October of next year. I have no doubt what the current administration's answer to would be that question because we discussed it endlessly during my trip to Afghanistan. They would support President Karzai because they know him, they like him. He has a tremendously good relationship with President Bush. Every 2 weeks they have a private, secure television two-way conversation in which they discuss the issues, and Karzai, and they see Karzai in that role. The official answer of the U.S. government is we won't support anyone, although one member of the U.S. government is a possible candidate, I would note. And he came to Asia Society and vigorously denied that he was a candidate, so everyone assumed he was. But that is a decision that we don't have to make now, and we have to think very, very hard about. The conventional wisdom is, whatever the problems of this government, no one would be better. But there are plenty of qualified, impressive Afghans in the country, and they have to sort themselves out. I'm not ducking your question. I think it's a huge issue for the next president. I just can't answer it.
The gentleman in the second row there.
Chia Chen, freelance correspondent. And first, thank you for you take over the chairmanship of the Asian Society. At the end of the later period of the 14 years Vietnam War, and the dormant theory was very popular. But after the war, that not happened. And now, in this African war, the alternative to the win the war is not an option. Should the country have debate on the alternative to win the war? Thank you.
Oh, to some extent, this depends on what we mean by win. And this also applies to Iraq. What is the I would prefer to use words like succeed and then define what our national security interests are. If we define winning as a stamping out the Taliban, victory is not achievable. If you define success as negotiating the Taliban coming into the government as a partner, given what they stand for and given their unbreakable partnership with al-Qaeda, that's a defeat. So let's rule out those two goals. You can't kill every Taliban, and you can't let them come into the government. And that's why I'm so concerned when I read reports, as I did this morning, that the Karzai government is negotiating with Hekmatyar, who is at the top of our terrorist list, who is an extraordinarily dangerous man, and who is... And who the government is looking for ways to co-opt, which I think could be very dangerous to Americans and to our goals. So what should we do? The one thing I haven't mentioned that I want to underscore is the high potential of reconciliation programs. It's a very substantial percentage of the existing members of the Taliban are either in it for the money or they were driven into it because their poppy seeds were destroyed, or... you know, they are people who are disillusioned. A lot of those could be brought over. There was a reconciliation program. The British worked on it. The U.S. funded it. We withdrew our funds. There were questions about its administration. I talked with five Taliban defectors in Khust who were extraordinarily upset because they said every promise the government had made to them for what they would get, land and jobs and so on, if they came back, every one of those was broken, according to these five guys. But that is a good option. So what is success? Success is a government that can function, that can hold the Taliban at bay without eliminating them, that can get the drug culture under control. I agree with the gentleman who said corruption can't be completely eliminated, but I don't agree that we should give up on it. And we have to have buy-in from the Pakistanis. Now, one point about Afghanistan... and I think this applies also to Iraq, but I don't have as much of a feeling for Iraq. There is no long-term settlement of the problem in Afghanistan which doesn't have buy-in from all of Afghanistan's neighbors, starting with Pakistan. But unfortunately, that includes Iran. There is no way you can do this without Iran's buy-in as well. In fact, the Karzai government exists today because of a relationship during the bond negotiations in 2001-2 between the American negotiator and the Iranian negotiator. But the countries that need to participate in stabilizing Afghanistan include India, which always worries about Pakistani influence, Russia, over the horizon but still with a role, China, which never stops to remind us that they have a border with Afghanistan, a small one, about 90 kilometers, but it's a border, possibly Uzbekistan. And we have to do that. And the failure to do it is a great shame. There will be a massive pledging conference in Paris next month, at which the Afghans will ask for some, what, $51 billion was the figure you told me, Saad? And the world is going to get up and pledge money, but no one's going to talk about what that money goes for, what the political settlement is, and that's not going to work.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ambassador Holbrooke has been very generous with his time and maybe a little too generous if I don't get him to his airplane. So let me have one last question. The lady in the third row there.
Hi, my name is Sarah Petron, and I'm with the International Committee for the Red Cross. And I was wondering if you could comment in regard to challenges in foreign assistance reform on two initiatives that are currently going on in Washington. One, to create a cabinet-level agency that would better coordinate foreign assistance, and another, to deal with the civil-military affairs in order to deal with PRTs better. To make sure that the stabilization and reconstruction, but to add more funds and resources.
I personally think a separate cabinet agency for overseas development is a bad idea. It further fragments the U.S. government. I know it's popular in Europe, but we have more strategic interests. I just don't like it. I know that it's been supported by several of the candidates. The second point, I'm not quite sure what the proposal is you're talking about. There are just so many proposals out there. But I want to go back to what I said earlier. This privatization of American foreign policy, contract employees, I see one in the room, but I won't name him because he used to work for me, is just not, I don't like it. I don't think it's right. Maybe call me old-fashioned, but we should be doing our own work. Police training, $800 million contracts to DynCorp. Inadequately trained trainers who come on short duty, don't know what country they're in, are very, very well paid. Some of them with the tax breaks make more than the President of the United States or close to it. And I visited those guys. I would prefer to have seen that done by Americans in uniform or civilians trained under the U.S. But you see, to do all that, and this is a good way to conclude, to do all that requires an administration to get up and say to the American public, Afghanistan is totally different from Iraq. Iraq is going to be settled in November by the American public. They're going to choose either a candidate who wants to continue the war or a candidate who, either Democrat, who wants to phase out or draw down. But all three candidates say we have to succeed in Afghanistan. The administration says we have to succeed. But nobody in power ever gets up and says, this is going to be a really long effort and we have to restructure for it. The highest level people working on the problem in Washington are at the highest Deputy Assistant Secretary of State level, maybe not even that. And the people are not, they don't have the experience or the background or the knowledge for it. And we need to restructure and face up to this. And whoever the next president is, they've all said they're going to change it. But the starting point, to get to your point about civil military affairs, the starting point is to make sure the American public is not surprised as this war drags on into its 8th, 9th, and 10th year at a cost acceptable to us, provided we have a strategy for success, which includes the Pakistani area. And if we're not honest with the American public, and I don't think people have been in charge of this policy, we can't ever go to the Congress, we being the U.S. government, not me, but the U.S. government can't ever go to the Congress and say, we need to reach a multi-year agreement on, let's say, that agricultural program I was talking about earlier. And here's why we need to do it. So each year they go up with an appropriation. From 2002 to 2007, they asked for a total of $11 billion. Most of it, as Tony said, security money. Last year, suddenly noticing that they'd neglected Afghanistan, they asked for $10.5 billion in 1 year. They called it the surge year. And they got it. It didn't change the situation. It got worse. This year they're asking for $5.5 billion. But they don't say to the Congress, let's talk in terms of 5 years, and let's really think about what we're doing. And the Congress, in turn, gives them the money and argues about it and doesn't do end-use checks. So we need to start, the next administration needs to start with clarity about Afghanistan as a long-term venture and a clear differentiation from that other war.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of your questions, but I, again, have to thank Ambassador Holbrooke for a superb address. Good afternoon.